Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening. Dear Canando Sangha, my name is Eli. I'm reporting here from the temples up north. I've lived at all three of Zen Center's temples, I can now say, and currently split my time between City Center in the city and then also our Green Dragon Temple, otherwise known as Green Gulch. So good to be here with you. Here in the Zendo, and then greetings to those online, especially my buddy Gail. I can see, I'm assuming that's the Gail that I know and used to practice and live with for many years. Before I get started, I do want to express gratitude to the many causes and conditions that brought us all here today. Too innumerable to name. I don't want to start with the carbon and stars many, many, many years ago. But particularly to just the trees, the seeds, the air, the ocean, and to the ancestors that brought us here today, stemming back from the seven Buddhas before Buddha, all the way through Les K, who I understand established this temple, my teacher, Renzo Ed Satazan, for providing us this place to practice. Indeed, such a rare opportunity, if you think about it. Sometimes when I'm resisting coming to the Zendo or think I have a long day, I remember that there's this long string and hand from the universe offered to us on these cushions or chair. Also, before I start, just want to say thank you to Diane, and I'm sure there's others who coordinated. I know Teresa for inviting me here. Something I wanted to express is that for about the last decade or so, I've been central in Zen Center's different inclusion efforts. My former role there for the past 3 years was Director of Inclusion and Belonging. So I spent a lot of time looking at different communities, how sanghas come together, and was just very touched from coming into the parking lot to the beautiful dinner that was offered from Diane Travis, right? Sorry, and Ricky, wherever she is. And so if I'm a little lethargic, you can blame them for the lasagna and bread that they stuffed in me. But just the heart of this sangha is really felt. Sometimes people think, oh, go to these big temples, but people get lost in the shuffle. It's hard sometimes to actually feel that warm hand to warm hand, human connection. And so I just wanted to express, yes, how nice it is to be here. And now I will say something about something. So I have to confess, when being invited here, Teresa, I'm like, what should I talk about? What are they studying? And she said, oh, you're new to the Sangha, so please give a way-seeking mind. And then I sat down at the table tonight, like, what are you going to talk about? So normally, I would probably talk about bubbles for the full 40 minutes, about impermanence, the other three marks of existence, and have you blowing bubbles the whole time. But you're going to have to, I might bring out bubbles, but for now, I'm going to just give a what we call way-seeking mind talk. For those of you who may not know what that is, it's basically sometimes a string of events, but more so the teachings, the support, the way that I connected to practice throughout my life to this present moment. And so I hope that it's not just a tale, but that there's something you can relate to, learn from, and if not, you have cushions and know how to sit meditation, so please support yourself. So they say sometimes in practice, rather than describing the moon or concepts, you should take someone outside and just point to it. So I'm going to have us actually start with an exercise that hopefully will help support that moon pointing. So if you would, it'll be easier if your eyes are closed or cast them down if you're comfortable. And unlike Zazen, I'm going to encourage you to really actually use your imagination, your full-bodied imagination. So go ahead and just start by taking a couple of grounding breaths. I know we just sat Zazen, but just to transition to this particular moment in time. So first, just start by feeling your body sitting. Perhaps the contact point or the weight of your body on the cushion or chair. Feel whatever is touching the ground, whether it's your feet or your bottom. Really just sensing into that connection. Feel into your hands wherever they are resting. And then just take one long inhale and slow exhale. And now gently bring your attention inward, perhaps to the innermost part of your body. Just noting any internal movements, temperature, tightness or ease. I know it's hard sometimes with our attention, our awareness, but if you can, just try to feel from within the body, not just placing the mind, the attention somewhere in the body. Now starting to become more aware of the surface of the body or the skin. Contact of the clothing that cover you, the air that surrounds you. Still sensing in from the body, not the mind. Now go ahead and widen that a bit more to the sounds in the room. Other bodies. The recognition that there's space around us. And now even wider to the building. Perhaps the land and city. And I know this is a rather quick journey, but from there, just go ahead and allow the sense of expansion to stretch into the sky, space, and cosmos. And from there, just notice where exactly does this inside of you end and the outside of you begin? Not from a conceptual sense, but a felt sense. There's no right or wrong answer. So this question of where I end and the world begins has been central to my life, or an inquiry that has followed me. And you're welcome to stay there. You can come back to the room. So even before I had language for it, I had this sort of experience. What I thought was separation turned out to actually be a meeting point. So this exercise is not something I did purposely, but many times I was lying in bed as a young boy, that's what would be going on in my imagination, really aware of this inner world and not really sure where this inner world and the outer world, where there was separation. And like we did, I'd feel myself internally all the way through the sheets out into the great beyond. Where do I stop? Where does the rest of this begin? And so thinking about this way-seeking mind, I think the expression that would make more sense to me is a way-seeking body. And so at some point, at least I'll tell you from my version, and you will know your own, as a young 2-year-old, I would suspect, like many of us, we are completely immersed in our environment. There is no real separation of I'm here and that's there. I know my mom used to tell me that I would do wonderful things like take syrup, spill it on the floor, and just enjoy it on the carpet, immersed. At some point, when we're all in that kind of action, a guardian or someone says, no, don't do that. And our poor little systems, even though they're right, we can't destroy things, our system takes that in as a jolt. And instead of cognitively understanding, I'm destroying something, this carpet, we tend to internalize that as that immersion is wrong, that there's something amiss there. A little bit further on in life, maybe 4, 5, 6 if we're lucky to get there, we start to do this other thing where we learn about comparison. Might start by looking over at another person's stick figure. We all have our version, but we really start to perceive a sense of there's an out there, there's an in here. We learn about othering, judgment, comparison, and self-doubt, which are actually all part of the human experience, turns out. And so what happens is we start to experience a gap between this inner world and this outer world that we then try to correct. Recently, there's a way I've been thinking about this, that when we're young, we're learning to try to tend towards who we will be when we're older. And when we're older, we often are learning to reconnect or learn from who we've been. So it's kind of like after we cross that early stage of immersive, embodied engagement, we tend to do a great deal of forward planning and reaching and looking for some day to arrive where we'll get at some perceived mile marker. And then at some point, we, down the road, end up in a therapist's office or a Zen center or something of that, trying to decondition, unpack, and hopefully learn from our past to realign with that sense of authenticity, living life more immersive and embodied and engaging with the world around us. So with that said, I think I'll talk about some suffering. That's kind of what we tend to do in that kind of recollection. My early childhood did not come with a lot of it. I was very fortunate to come into the world to 2 very caring and loving parents. Just to give you a small snapshot, my mom was an early adapter of yoga, and my father was an educator, a philosophy PhD to be exact. Funny enough, he had a previous marriage. My sister Shannon we grew up separately. She had a reverend for a stepfather. Anyways, fast forward, she's the 11th bishop of Vermont, and I'm sitting here with you all, so we kind of tease that we have our dad's kind of mind of trying to figure out what's going on and had different influences. But to the fact of suffering, My first, I think, real encounter with suffering was when I was about 10 years old. I was diagnosed with alopecia. So this isn't by choice. It's very helpful now. But it came about pretty quick, 10 years old, in a barbershop. The barber trying to explain that some patch of missing hair was not his fault. So they were whispering back there, and finally, weeks later, understood that I had a condition that just had random hair loss. So I don't want to go too much into it, but over the next couple of years, ended up losing eyebrows, went through tons of teasing, got called Baby Buddha, and would tear up. Funny how that worked out. But really, what I want to say is that it kind of moved me more into that state of separation. And a lot of folks experience that with whatever causes them to not feel a sense of belonging. So of course, other in comparison, self-doubt, all of these things came forth, plus a chip on my shoulder, because I now had something to prove. So a lot of that suffering was met with avoidance, hardening, vindictiveness, ill will, but then also a lot of bypassing, like, this doesn't actually affect me medically. I get sweat in my eyes. Or it could be worse if I was a female in a female body. So that was another habit. I don't know if any of you do that, but kind of bypass your problems by looking at something else. So it's a bit of wisdom with avoidance. Around that same age, my parents informed me that my father had lymphoma. And so instantly for me, this is in the 90s, I just equated to death. And I remember specifically that it created a huge shift in how he showed up. He was very successful and really good socially, and it really did change him, having to face his own, everyone's life limitations at some point. And so looking back, that was a spark to contemplate sickness, old age, and death. You know, ideas of what is this life, what happens to us, and how we can meet things that we can't control. So at the same time, obviously, life kept moving along. And more things like how to fit in, how to succeed, became kind of center. A lot of questions that came as an early person of like, what is this, turned into, am I doing this right? And a constant, again, checking into how I was showing up from a performance stance. And then there's that huge gap between who we think we are and who we think we should be. So I want to fast forward a little bit and go again into more like logistical or practical matters. Got through high school, A-OK, into college. I did marry my high school sweetheart, so hopped into that kind of building a life from a very early age. We checked all the boxes, did trips, yada, yada, yada. And later in our 20s, started to, after we got done partying, looked into like more wellness. And one of those things that we looked into was meditation with a secular teacher. It was, I think, transcendental, is that what it is? Just like the little mantra. During that time, my ex-cat had a miscarriage, so we were kind of bummed. We'd, you know, been married, I think, almost a decade at that point. And our teacher that we were working with said, before you hop back into that realm of life, it sounds like you guys would benefit from a long-term retreat or monastic practice. So we Googled some things, and before you knew it, we were at Tassajara, the monastery in Central California. Did not know we were showing up for Buddhism, but just over 14 years later, I sit here before you, so something took hold. Didn't end up going back to a corporate life. So the reason I bring that up is that my second encounter with death came around the same time. So I arrived at Tassajara on my 30th birthday, and this was just after my mom had gotten diagnosed with vascular dementia, which anyone who's bear witness for cancer or dementia, it's a rocky road. A lot I could say about that, but I wanted to kind of point out some of the differences on how I engaged with my parents' death. Oh, by the way, my dad did die when I was 19. I remember meeting that moment in a very particular way. It was September 14th, 2001. So this is 3 days after 9/11. So I did two things. Once, again, stuffed some of my emotions through non-productive means, weed, alcohol, some things. But then also felt that I could not actually mourn him because our country and the world was going through crisis. So that tendency, again, to push things away. So again, fast forward to my time at Zen Center. Many visits, challenges, and the slow letting go with my mom's condition. It was my first half-day sit at Tassajara, which they have, and the night before, I had gotten word that I needed to return home instantly, that my mom may have had a mini-stroke and that I needed to actually like help her get into assisted living. Although I could not snap my fingers and leave Tassajara, any of you know that have been there, it takes coordination. So there I was the next day. The staff was very kind, said I did not have to participate in the half-day sit, just take care of yourself, but I proceeded anyway. And maybe you've had this experience in Zazen, but this was profoundly kind of the moment where I landed, or my heart landed in this practice. So instead of rushing, fixing, distracting, I just sat. And it's hard to fully describe. The grief was there, the fear was there, the sadness was there, the tears were there, but then also the sound of blue jays were there, the light reflecting off of the tatami, the smell of incense, and squirrels chirping. And it was so amazing just to feel my breath. Everything was completely there together, nothing to be resolved and nothing missing. So Suzuki Roshi, our founder of our lineage that we're here from, said the purpose of Zazen is to attain the freedom of our being physically and mentally. And so that was a turning point where kind of this mind that had been trying to seek turned towards the body. So that's part of what I mean by way seeking body. Nothing to solve, but learning how to be in relationship with what's around us. And you could catch me after. Something else came along that way. My daughter, Maya, was born in 2017. Greatest teacher. And for those of you who know or are a parent, you can probably attest to this. But there's something very direct in my experience with her. There's moments where you're not thinking about yourself at all. You're not managing identity or performing, but just responding to this little being completely. At the same time, you start to see something else, that this being is not separate from you, not just emotionally, but in like kind of causality, conditionally. There's gestures and expressions that I see in her that I can tell that she's working through, and it's almost like I can feel threads that come from way beyond my lifetime and through us. And it's also very clear that I am the culprit now of kind of ruffling up that immersion that I was talking about. And there's something that I can say that this is me and that that's her. But it feels like more of a continuation, a transmission, or a re-expression. Yet at the same time, she's 100% her own being. She's not owned, she's not knowable, not controlled. And so this was really eye-opening in practice that that we could be two, not one, and that both things could be true, not separate and not the same. So a theme that keeps coming up is what I think is separate is actually a meeting point. And so I said I was going to bring out bubbles here. And so I wanted to introduce bubbles. They have been the most amazing teacher and teaching companion for me. Started in assisted living communities I was teaching in, where folks had you'd go in there and, of course, do the dumb thing and say, oh, this is mindfulness, and breathe and relax. And it's like someone's been sitting in a chair for, you know, days. So I found that those who could blow bubbles love to blow them. Brings a great sense of presence and a little automatic bubble gun for those who weren't able to express their breath in that way. Later on, I've taught mindfulness to first and second graders for the past 7 years, a great tool, but they've now made it into the Zendo. So if you ever come take a half day sit with me, Zazen instruction, these are coming out. I'm talking about the relative and the absolute, these are coming out. Three marks of existence, you get the point. I'm profoundly in love with bubbles. So I did want to share some tonight, and I have some for everybody before you leave. Helps with the parasympathetic system, vagus nerve. Really a good replacement for all the things I used to smoke. But this is one way that I do, again, understand some of reality. Just watching a bubble can look like a separate thing, but it's not. It's the air inside, it's the air outside, and a thin surface where conditions meet. And that surface, it's not actually separate. In the same way that I thought what was me is not separate from what's around me. It's a meeting point. So really, everything I'm not makes me everything I am. So this connects me to something that's really been important in my practice. As I said, I've, for the last half decade or so, led Zen centers, inclusion and belonging practices. And in Zen, we talk about this ability to cultivate a deep inner sense of belonging that's not reliant on external forces, right? However, what I've come to see is that inner belonging does not arise in isolation. And that's part of what I was pointing to when I spoke about how it felt to be here. It's shaped in relation, it's shaped by how we're met, it's shaped by how we meet others and the conditions that we're in, just like the bubble. So again, the inner and outer are not separate. They're informing each other all the time. I have just a few more things before I wrap up. I wanted to touch on lineage. So I guess I'll share a short story from when I visited Berkeley Zen Center not too long ago. If you haven't been there, I encourage you to go there. It's so sweet how all of these temples have their own unique flavor, and then something that's just that reminds us, I think, of home. But I was in there, and they have a kind of a abbot's quarters, and I was glancing around, and I, of course, saw pictures of Mel Weissman, who's, I guess, my great-great-grandfather in the Dharma, but also Sanaki Roshi, for those of you who knew him, a beautiful picture of just his mudra and thumbs touching. I saw a picture of a priest and friend that we lost a couple of years ago, Curtis Fabens, who I inherited his zagu. This okesa that I'm wearing, I noticed, was Lou Richman, who was is my teacher, Ed Sadazan's teacher. And while I was standing there, just in the midst of these teachers and ancestors, it really occurred to me that I am literally quite dressed in Buddha's robe. Everything that I was wearing, that I was expressing, was something that has been passed down, something that was cared for. And so this life is not something that I own, it's something that I'm participating in. And what I think of practice is not mine. It's actually something that I've received. I mean, I have a body, but I have now received such a practice. And at some point along the way, I think I've also felt that practice shifts from trying to understand yourself to caring for what has been given. So it's kind of auspicious looking back to be invited to speak here and give a way-seeking mind talk, supposedly. Usually in our temples, students are invited to give them during their first practice period or if they're going through the Bodhisattva initiation ceremony, formerly known as Jukai. And then we're also asked to give these talks when we step into the role of Shuso, or head student, and get our teaching designation. And so a recent transition as of this last week, I was invited to be head of practice or the Tanto at Green Gulch Farm, which is definitely a teaching and more than anything a service position to support new students, all students, in their path, and my heart is elated, absolutely. Another big mile marker is this weekend. The first time the student that I've worked with will be receiving the Bodhisattva precepts and taking Jukai. There's a sense of alignment with this shift. So one of the last questions that I leave to you and has been a question for me is that if we don't create all these conditions, but we're living from them, what do we do? And for me, it's come down to a couple of questions that I'll pass on to you that are pretty simple. The first one is, what is needed here? Does this moment need care? Does it need honesty? Does it need a boundary, compassion, or change? So, moment by moment, we are somewhat like an artist who did not choose necessarily their canvas, or perhaps even the colors that fill their palette. But we are responsible for how this life is expressed. So, as Ed Brown encourages us to do with ingredients, look at the ingredients in front of you and dream up something for your life. It's been an invitation that I've tried to step into. So in closing, if we return to the beginning when we were just sitting here, feeling the body, feeling the room, feeling part of what is, the way that I really did start out trying to understand life, and somewhere along the line began to learn how to be in it. What I thought was separate is actually a meeting point. In any given moment, what we think our boundaries actually are boundless. So anyhow, that was my way-seeking mind, becoming a way-seeking body. And perhaps together, becoming a way-seeking universe. I do think the world needs it. So thank you for your time and attention. I hope something of that was valuable. And if not, please wash your ears out with the sound of the gentle traffic just outdoors.
So let's take the three questions that
okay.
you had.
Okay, that's what I was going
to
ask.
Break up into groups of three, and what we're going to do is have take turns, 2 minutes each person, and we're going to go over those questions. Please listen to the person, don't interrupt them, and then after 2 minutes, I'll ring the bell. Next person, 2 minutes, another next person, and then I'll open it. We'll open the floor up to all of you to talk to each other. But try to keep an open mind, listen with the ears and your whole body, and let the person express themselves and not interrupt them. Thank you.
Which question did you...
The three questions that you had, that you were...
Oh, that I just read.
Yep.
I think this question is nice.
Okay.
If we don't create all these conditions, but we're living them, what do we do? That could be one. The other could just be, what is needed here in this very moment? And so that will be something for you to answer with the other person in this moment. Can you just check in and see what's needed? And it doesn't have to necessarily apply to the person, but just it could apply to your life. But however that lands...
So while that's being passed on, anything that came up for you that you'd like to share, but, whatever you shared with each other, it's very confidential, so try to keep it to yourself. But if you'd like to make a general, ask Eli a question, or you'd like to know something or find out by sharing, then please go ahead. Let me know. Okay.
I actually have a question that I came in with. Thank you. I just wanted to see, I was very interested in when you were talking about bringing your daughter or child, I'm sorry, into the practice. And that is a question I have as a, being a parent is definitely a practice. And, as Rumi says, we always say the parent, it's my child. And Rumi says, nobody belongs to someone. And, that is something I've always think about. Do you have a recommendation of how we can share our practice with our children without turning them off against
Absolutely.
It, especially if they're like 13.
Absolutely.
And like any books or any advice or, something that you've seen, an approach that has been useful would be very appreciated.
Yes, thank you. And I'll cover kind of the range that I know are entry points. So for one, I've not requested practice of my daughter. That happened maybe, an attempt of that maybe happened once when she was very little and then never again. So from an early age, it was pretty clear, I learned like most parents do, that kids have to feel connected to something, especially something like a religious practice or, practice in general. So for me, leading by example has always worked well. So not asking Maya to come sit, but there's times where I'll be sitting in the morning and all of a sudden there's like a little body next to me. And so there's been that space. I teach a lot of young people, and If you were to kind of just take it out of, you know, a snapshot, there's no language about that you'd hear in mindfulness or even Buddhism. It's a lot about play, about actually enhancing the presence that they already have. So part of it is just also understanding, like, what is it they actually need from it? Because it's quite different than what we need from it, or what, you know, or what we're trying to instill in them. There's usually another way of cultivating those attributes. So that was evident. From my own experience, my mom had, well, I was very participatory in meditation and yoga until I was like 8, 9. I'm like, that's not cool, Mom. Because I had the cool hat, you know. I told you I learned about this, these things like comparison. However, there was a lot of times where life invited stretching. So I've always been a soccer player and track and stuff like that. So the yoga came in, nervous for a test, nervous for an event. All of a sudden, the thing Mom taught me with breathing. So for teenagers, I would say that there's usually an entry point where it actually would be very good medicine or a kind of remedy. So on an ethical standpoint, there's tons of Buddhist stories and koans that are actually kind of cool to younger folks. Like, you know, it's great the day that we live in. Mindfulness is secular. Zen teachings and koans are kind of like cool. And so it's a lot about how it's presented. And an offering from them, not something that you want them to do. So, you know, this is all stuff you know. So those are kind of, I think, the general things is meeting them where they're at. Set an example, because we all know from people we grew up around, parents, guardians, like, that person acted like that, so I'm not going to be like that. Very strong reactions, right? And that sometimes can shape our life. Usually we remember aspects that distill kindness, attention, and presence. And so if you're engaging in those things, there's a good chance that everyone around you will get a sense of it and a taste of it. And then when the time is right, practice and those kind of things are a lot more inviting. So thanks for the question.
Just along those same lines, it reminds me of when I was much younger, in my sort of early to mid-20s. And I'd always been raised as a traditional American Protestant and, you know, Methodist churches and everything. But I kind of got off into some interesting other things like yoga. Mm. I really got interested in yoga. And I was talking to an Indian friend, another student who was from India. And I mentioned that I was really interested in yoga, and I asked if he was, or he and his friends from India were. And he said, oh, no, that's that old-fashioned dusty stuff that our parents do. We wouldn't have anything to do with that.
I just want to give a thanks for the bubbles. The immediacy, the fact that they are ephemeral, they're so much in the moment. They're neither mean or there.
Yeah, they're thanks. Beautiful. You can dip them. One thing I like, if you go out into the sunlight, you can kind of see it in here. You'll notice that each bubble reflects, well, we'll call it the sun, even though it's that light, twice. So you're seeing it, one on the external layer, one on the internal layer. To me, that kind of represents the relative and the absolute, right? It's also amazing that bubbles, if you look at them, they all come from the same solution, like we do, the cosmos, are given air, and then have this apparent form of separation from this universe that created it, all popping at the different rate due to causes and conditions. There's a lot that could be learned from bubbles. Please don't get me started unless we'll go till 10 o'clock. Other questions?
They stick together sometimes.
They do stick together.
Anybody have a question online? No? No. Okay. Great. It's past 9.
Okay.
So let's... we're going to call it a night. Thank you, Eli.
Thank you very much. Yes. Really appreciate you being here.
Closing sutra and then the Pali refuges.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.